This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. You may have read the phrase, the Internet of Things, but what does it really mean? To put it simply, the power of the Internet to be in all of the regular objects that we use today. For example, what if your umbrella were able to tell you when you'd need it, or your prescription bottle lit up when it was time for you to take your pills? These things already exist, and our next guest not only helped develop them, but he's willing to bet that the real future of the Internet is an array of connected things, not the slab of glass that is in your pocket. David Rose is an entrepreneur and instructor at the MIT Media Lab, specializing in how digital information interfaces with the physical environment. His new book is called Enchanted Objects: Design, Human Desire, and the Internet of Things. And David, welcome to Word of Mouth.
It's great to be here.
So what is an enchanted object?
Well, I believe that we need a new type of relationship with our technology. You know, today we have these glass slabs that we all carry around, these smartphones or phablets or tablets in our pocket, and they're incredibly demanding of our attention. We seem to be glued to them most of the day. And because of that, it really diminishes the moments that we spend with others in the world. And the vision for an enchanted object is when all of the apps and all of the things that we do with our phones leap off of the screen into everyday objects. And the result is a much simpler, much more tangible, an interaction with technology that's really preferable over this convergence device.
So what might an example be of something that we use now? I guess I'm thinking of the Fitbit.
Right. Well, rather than having to go to an app to see how many steps you've gotten, instead you can just wear a bracelet. I'm actually wearing one right now that shows you through five little LEDs sort of how many steps you've taken today. And so that's an example of really simplifying an interface and embedding it into an everyday object, in this case jewelry. And enchanted objects will be, almost – It's hard to imagine things that won't be connected. You know, we have examples of there's a tennis racket that has an accelerometer in it, which basically measures how well you're hitting, where you're hitting, whether it's a forehand or backhand shot. You know, these things are getting embedded into sports equipment, into jewelry, into furniture. I have a Facebook coffee table sitting in the middle of my living room that allows me to sort of see in a very passive way the photos that friends are taking, because the Facebook coffee table listens to the conversation. And when I mention people or places that appear in photos, it sort of gradually shows those photographs in the middle of the living room.
I've also watched a really charming video of you at your home with your son looking over the Google Maps in your coffee table.
Yeah, that's right.
Lots of information in your coffee table.
I think that's sort of the promise of an enchanted object, is you take all of these services and all of these apps, and you can sort of have the best version of them. You know, you can have a map that's quite large, or a Skype connection between my kid and my parents that they can just access simply by opening a cabinet. So we have this Skype cabinetry, which offers a dedicated connection, which just means they talk much more frequently.
So these all sound like objects of the future and, I guess, present in your home. But you point out that there are enchanted objects that we've looked to in the past. The barometer is one that you mention.
Right. When I was growing up, I grew up in the Midwest in Madison, Wisconsin. My father, who's a physician, had sort of a ritual that he would perform every morning. He would get up and leave their bedroom, and on the way to their bathroom with his towel wrapped around his waist, he would tap this beautiful old brass barometer and sort of see which direction the barometric pressure was trending. And as a designer, I was always admired that incredibly simple interaction paradigm of, it's just an object, it's always on, it's always showing information that's relevant, it gives you the change in that information. Like, what a simple, delightful, intuitive experience. You didn't need to ever upgrade the apps. It never made you feel stupid. It was a beautiful object that sort of fit into the home. So, it had this sort of sense of adornment to it. So I hope that we can design interfaces that are just as lovely and that we appreciate having around in our lives as that sort of barometer.
Well, the word enchanted brings up thoughts of what is magic or mystical, but it is really just technology and circuits and programming and software, is the idea that we don't really know how it works. It just presents.
Yeah, I recently did a workshop at the Copenhagen Interaction Design Institute with a magician, and the students took everyday objects, in this case from IKEA, and made them enchanted. So there was a magic lantern that would listen to the story that you're telling your child and display lighting effects like thunder and lightning. There was some shades that knew if you were in front of them, and they would open or close based on whether you needed privacy or more sunlight. So these are, you know, everyday objects that have a sense of what you need and can take care of you.
You have those in your own home, according to the video I watched. You know, your shades are going up as you're pouring your coffee. Your son's having this conversation with a presumed grandparent inside of this
yes.
cabinet. But what happens to an enchanted house when the power goes out? As we saw during Hurricane Sandy, New York, New Jersey, all of these big city areas that were dependent on power for everything, from charging their phone to gas pumps, was gone.
Right. Well, I mean, I think one of the things you learn from interacting with magicians is that they don't reveal the mechanism of the trick. You know, things are more enchanted if they just work and always work, and you don't need to know all of the circuitry and all of the whether it's connecting through the Wi-Fi network or through the phone or through the cellular network. And I think increasingly, to address your power question, I'm working with a company called Sunsprite, which is making a little clip, almost like a tie clip or button, that detects whether you get enough bright light in the morning, so that your mood improves, and it also resets your circadian rhythm, so you're more likely to sleep, to get a full night's sleep. And what's nice, what's really magical about that device is you never have to charge it. It has a little piece of solar, a little photovoltaic recharger on it, like those old calculators did. And so you never have to plug it in and you never have to charge it. So, like, that's really magical if these things just work and can harvest power either from the sun or from movement, then you never have to worry about power outages.
So we're kind of imagining this place where all of our objects work together. It's kind of Jetson's home in my mind. Those 1950 commercials about the home of the future and these enchanted systems. But where is, you know, the Rosie the robot that we've been promised for years and years? Is this the enchanted object taking the place?
Well, in the book, I talk about six different aspirations that have been revealed through fairy tales or through the Jetsons or through Bilbo Baggins and The Hobbit, or, you know, sort of fantasy stories or science fiction. And I try to organize the coming Internet of Things into these six buckets. And they are omniscience, the interest in being all-knowing, telepathy, connecting to other humans, safekeeping, like protection, immortality, having a long and quantified maybe life, teleportation, sort of friction-free travel, and creative expression, that is the ability to play and to learn in a new way. Those are all aspirations that are revealed through narratives, you know, through fiction, through myth. And I think those are the things that we should work on as inventors and innovators to try to satisfy those age-old desires.
Those human desires and drives are aspirations, things that are bringing us forward. What is your sort of nightmare of the future?
Well, I teach at the Media Lab, and there are lots of different ways to envision our relationship to technology. You know, the glass slab that I talk about is one future, one where we have this call and response relationship to technology, and we're sort of lost in our screens. Another future is when everything becomes wearable. And I think that's sort of a nightmare future, because you remember when we all would wear headphones and listen to different music, and that really cut us off socially from other people? If everyone's wearing a headphone and listening to something different, it's hard to interact with other people. Just imagine what happens when everyone's wearing a Google Glass-like display and seeing a different view of reality. Another future that I also think is a nightmare is one where the technology isn't located in and on us, but it's distributed into social robots. The robotics community really wants to believe in robots that have human likeness, that have the same ambulatory, you know, can walk around, can interact with us just like we interact with other people. And the more that we get closer and closer to human likeness, the more that we'll be creating things that appear to us as zombies or the old Jewish folklore Gollum. Hmm. And the more that they will threaten our own humanity and we won't want to live with them. So I think that's another nightmare future is human-like robots. So I think the most preferable future is when we have this huge array of tools, of things that we ordinarily use in the world that all get imbued with a little bit more intelligence. And that's sort of where I hope computers will go.
But what about our concerns about data? You know, all of this is based on data. Do you have any concerns about what happens to that information in this era when data privacy has been compromised in so many ways?
Yeah, I think it's a great point and an important thing to be worried about. I certainly, when we designed the Vitality GloCap, we imagined that there are lots of reasons that other people might want to participate in the knowledge of whether people took a medication or didn't take a medication. But we made all of those services an opt-in. So the first principle is don't make it a default in and then an opt-out, but instead make it the inverse, which is if you want an email to go to a loved one every week that shows whether you did or didn't take a med, like my GloCaps, I share data with my father and he shares his data with me. So we can give each other a helpful nudge if we're not doing very well. And so people don't have to do that. If you don't want the data to go to a doctor, you don't have to. If you don't want the data to go to a pharmacy to facilitate an automatic refill of that medication, you don't have to. So I think, you know, the first principle is be clear and make everything an opt-in. I think an important second principle that my industry needs to do a better job at communicating and providing is an absolution button. With my Nest internet-connected thermostat, I should be able to say, forget everything you ever knew about me.
Hmm.
You know, like stop learning, because that some of these objects are all about learning you so that you don't have to learn it, but it can learn you over time and it can take care of you over time. But you should be able to just clear its memory. You know, every world religion has a metaphor for absolution. Mm-hmm. It's mostly about a forgetting, right?
Right.
And these objects should give you forgiveness / absolution / lobotomize, you know, so you can start afresh.
David, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Virginia. I've really enjoyed it.
David Rose is an entrepreneur and instructor at the MIT Media Lab, and he specializes in how digital information interfaces with the physical environment. His new book is called Enchanted Objects: Design, Human Desire, and the Internet of Things. Now, you can find a link to watch a short video of David in his home from the New York Times at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Up next, our enchantment with objects continues with the story of an audiophile who discovers a treasure trove of 20th century hillbilly records in a dumpster. That's when Word of Mouth continues after a short break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. You know the old saying, one man's trash is another man's treasure. Well, for passionate collectors, that holds especially true. Our next story illustrates the old maxim quite literally and comes to us from McSweeney's monthly program, The Organist.
My name is Nathan Salzberg. I'm the curator of the Alan Lomax Archive. In late March 2010, I got a phone call from a friend here in Louisville that a friend of a friend had been on a dumpster job that afternoon and had brought home from that job a few boxes of 78 RPM records. Knowing that I have an interest in music of the 78 era, which is roughly the late teens to the early 40s, he called me and I was lying on the sofa, sort of not interested in going out that night. But I got up off the sofa and I drove over to the house and there were maybe 15 boxes of 78s on the floor and filled with maybe, you know, 20, 25 78s a box. The stuff was never really built to last to begin with, and folks who bought the stuff often didn't hold on to it or didn't treat the records well, so they haven't survived. But I didn't have my hopes up, but I started looking, and right away I started seeing these names like Carter Family, Uncle Dave Makin, Jimmy Rogers, the big stars of the era. But as I kept going, I started seeing rarer and rarer records. And then I found a Mississippi John Hurt record. As a friend told me in the other room, I went pale and just said, we have got to go to this house. Like, we've got whatever, wherever the rest of these records are, we have to get them. We have to get them now. They had gotten the contract to clean out this house of a fellow whose name was Don Wall. And it was obvious that this guy had a considerable record collection of vernacular music from the 20s and 30s.
Please don't take my life. I got two little babies and a darling loving wife, that bad man. Oh, cruel.
So six of us piled into two cars. We drove out to Preston Highway on sort of the lip of the south end of Louisville. There was a full moon, and under the full moon, we dove into the dumpster, pulling out maybe 30 boxes of 78s. A friend of mine went in headfirst and came up with ketchup on his brow. There were all these bottles of family-sized ketchup in the dumpster. We weighed down two pickup trucks pretty well and then drove back to the house where my friends had been hanging out and proceeded to dig through some of the records. But apparently there were all these records left in the house. So I went home that night and I slept a very fitful night's sleep. And I woke up at about dawn the next day and waited until a decent hour to call the dumpster guy. I think I called him around 8. And he said, by all means, come out to the house this afternoon and anything you can take will be something we don't have to lug out. So that afternoon, I drive out to Preston Highway and they let me in. They give me a dust mask and I go downstairs and the place is just a disaster. I mean, the guy just lives in squalor. And I just sit in to carrying boxes up and just box after box after box after box upstairs. Things were coated in mold. I didn't have gloves on and my hands were just completely black. This was recorded in 1927 in Atlanta by a group called the Georgia Crackers, which was a couple of brothers named Paul and Leon Kofer and their friend Ben Evans, who played the guitar. And they were sons of a sawmill operator and also a hymnal compiler. And they learned their tunes, by and large, from their dad's sawmill men. Tony Russell, who really is sort of the world's expert on this stuff, had the very best description of this band, and he called them the sound of a band playing on the precipice of disintegration. When you hear a record like that, and especially when you've listened to country music from the 50s through the 70s, even outlaw music sounds like almost sounds like chamber music compared to that. I mean, that just sounds like it's totally hell for leather. It's like falling apart at the seams. They sound like they're racing to get the song in before the record ends. And they only have about 3 minutes. Ultimately, we found the collection consists of, there's about 2,500 items in what we call the Don Wall collection now. 99% of them are hillbilly records. So there's all of this just phenomenal and extremely rare string band material, all from all of these places, like, you know, in rural Tennessee and Kentucky and Virginia and North Carolina. What's great about the recordings made in the 20s and 30s is they were often made, not always, but they were often made locally. There were field recording sessions set up, and it just flushed out all of these just phenomenal, I mean, really characteristic local artists that had local styles that sounded like where they were from. Donald Pickett Wall, 75, died March 23rd. He left behind a brother, two nephews, and a niece. Cremation was chosen, and there was no funeral.
I have heard of a land on a faraway strand. 'Tis a beautiful home of the shore.
And that story was produced by Matt Frassica for The Organist. Some people like to spend their vacations relaxing on a beach. Others like visiting museums or eating at fine restaurants. And then there are those who like to get off the beaten path. Up next, a science writer plays nuclear tourist and visits the site of the Chernobyl disaster. That story after the news from NHPR.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Well done.
Mouth. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. On April 26, 1986, shortly after 1 in the morning, Reactor 4 at the Chernobyl nuclear power complex experienced a sudden and catastrophic power surge. The accident set off a series of explosions, a fire, and released massive amounts of radioactive material into the environment. Within months of the meltdown, 28 workers died from radiation poisoning, and more than 350,000 people were relocated. Over the ensuing years, related deaths have been harder to pin down, with estimates ranging from 4,000 to more than 200,000. 28 years later, it is a tourist destination. George Johnson recently visited Chernobyl and its surrounding villages and wrote about his trip for National Geographic magazine. George, what a pleasure to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Yes, thank you for inviting me.
So when did Chernobyl become an official tourist destination?
Well, people had been allowed to go there on officially sanctioned visits, you know, with guides who were, you know, trained in radiation danger and had monitoring equipment. But it was really fairly recently in 2011 that the Ukraine government decided to really get behind promoting tourism or at least, you know, making it a more popular activity and just, you know, making it known that people could sign up for tours with official tour groups and get on a bus in Kiev and head out there.
How much does it cost?
Oh, they vary a lot depending on whether you go for one day or if you do what I do and spend the night there at Chernobyl, which is a story in itself. So, you know, it can go up to, you know, hundreds of dollars for a couple of days.
So these are private tour operators, government tour operators?
Private tour operators, although the guides themselves that work for the companies are also employees of the government, and they're trained in a special program. You know, they're very knowledgeable about the science and the history, and they know where not to let people go.
Well, has it been popular as a tourist destination?
Yeah, I mean, it's not like, you know, Disneyland or Yosemite or anything, but the tours, you know, they can get booked far in advance. When I was there, it was really just in the early weeks after the uprising in Kiev, when they overthrew the existing president and he fled the country, and then in the Crimean Peninsula was just being occupied, and so as a result of that, the tour companies were kind of begging for tourists because people were hearing all of this, you know, alarming news about Ukraine, which of course has gotten only worse since then.
But, what a time to be there.
Yeah.
But I'm curious about the tour itself. I mean, can you walk us through it a little bit? Were you outfitted with hazmat suits or given any specific...
Yeah, no, nothing like that. I mean, they tell you to, you know, they recommend you, you know, you wear good sturdy shoes and long pants and long sleeves and, oh, don't eat the mushrooms. That was one of the, you know, the mushrooms concentrate biologically concentrate radionuclides, and, you know, as if we were going to eat mushrooms, and, you know, not to smoke or eat outside or just anything that might make it easier for a radioactive dust to get into your system. But, you know, basically just, you know, common sense precautions like that. We were we had our own personal little Geiger counters, electronic dosimeters that we could use to take readings and then see, you know, where the hot spots were. It almost became kind of an informal contest to see who could measure the highest dose.
Were there any disconcerting readings for you?
Well, I mean, you have to put it into perspective. I mean, this is such a tragedy, and the Chernobyl workers who were there on the front lines, the firemen and later the liquidators, they got exposed to just deadly, sickening amounts of radiation. And radiation of that level was measured commonly in a term they call the sievert, S-I-E-V-E-R-T. Mm-hmm. And what we were measuring were micro sievert, so millionths of a sievert. And I took out my Geiger counter on the flight over there, and I measured how much radiation was coming into the airplane from, you know, cosmic rays at high altitudes. And the readings I got there were higher than what I read in most places in Chernobyl, although there were a few big exceptions.
Wow, that is stunning. And of course, you, as you said, you know, radiation took a terrible toll on human beings exposed to the fallout. But what about the environmental toll? Are there visible effects of the degradation?
Well, not really. I mean, any effects are very subtle, which is a huge surprise. I mean, one that it's not subtle are the, they call it the Red Forest, and it's, you know, these large pine trees that just kind of died and turned orange, but, you know, they were very, very close to the reactor. But one thing that's so surprising is you get there, and, you know, I think before I knew anything about Chernobyl other than, you know, vaguely remembering the original news stories, I would have assumed that it was kind of a wasteland. But you get there, and it's a verdant forest of birch and pine trees, and it's burgeoning with wildlife. And there are, you know, ecologists are studying the effects of the radiation, and there's really two main people doing this, and they have opposing views. And, you know, one report seeing evidence of micromutations, but, you know, things you have to look pretty hard to see. And then the other team is not really even finding that. I mean, there's cases like birds with hooked beaks and things, but, you know, you really have to look. It's really amazing how well, these smaller animals particularly have been able to adapt.
Yeah, you describe it as quite a lush and pretty landscape, which is officially open to tourists in 2011. And were people visiting illegally before that? Was that possible?
Well, yes, they were. They were before that, and they still are, because, you know, it's much more exciting to sneak in. Now, people climb over the fences or get underneath them, and, you know, this is like about a 1,000-square-mile area that's cordoned off in Ukraine and in Belarus to the north. And people sneak through the fence, and they call themselves stalkers.
Mm-hmm.
And the name actually came from an old Russian science fiction story. But, and, you know, they just kind of, for years, have taken this great pride in secretly exploring Chernobyl and hiding from the guards.
Looking for a new travel destination that isn't overrun with tourists? Well, try Chernobyl. Our guest, George Johnson, is a journalist and science writer and wrote about a visit to Chernobyl. His article and some striking photographs of his visit are in the latest issue of National Geographic magazine. Well, I remember reading at the time that there were many people who didn't want to leave the area, and you discovered that there were people who did stay, that were living there.
Yeah, they came back, and they're mostly very old now. We met an elderly woman in her 80s in one of the little farming villages. Now, this was in the part of the zone, as they call it, the zone of exclusion that was, you know, quite a few miles away from the epicenter of the meltdown, but, you know, still measurable amounts of radiation above normal background, but she just insisted that she was going to go back there to her farmhouse and grow her potatoes. And when we talked to her, she was just saying, radiation, you know.
Wow.
Why am I going to worry about radiation? I'm 80 years old. I'm not going to have children. It's invisible. And she went in to talk about what a problem the Colorado potato bugs were.
Well, I know you're a science writer, George, and an intrepid sort. But what do you think? What do you think draws people to these sites?
I asked this Chernobyl stalker that particularly. Why did he keep going back? He said he'd been there about 100 times, and there was just something about this quiet, empty beauty, and just the fact of in trying to imagine, you know, like the city of Pripyat, which was once 40,000 people just a couple miles from the reactor, and now it's abandoned high-rises. And he described it sort of as a sick fascination, but I don't think it was really, really sick. It really inspired him to learn the history, and he really empathized with the firemen and the people who went through this horrible tragedy. And I mean, he'd heard about this accident since he was a child, and this was kind of his way of coming to understand how such a thing could happen and how people behave in extreme circumstances. For other tourists, the people on the bus, there were two young men who were working on a theater piece about what they described as the concept of quarantine.
Huh.
Sounded a little abstract to me, but and you know, they thought this was research. And then there was a young man from London who just decided he was going to spend his vacations doing what he called extreme tourism. And he had a next plan was to go to North Korea.
Well, I guess he's hitting him. But towns further out from Pripyat, you know, this surrounding area remain abandoned. What is the status of cleanup efforts there?
So the reactor that exploded, they covered, you know, very hastily right after the accident with concrete and steel and just anything they could drop on it at great danger to the workers, but, you know, it had to be done. And they call that the sarcophagus, a perfect name. And except that's, you know, kind of crumbling and leaking a little, and, you know, they're afraid that, you know, I mean, it's not going to last as long as the half-life of the nuclear material in the reactor core that still remain there. So they're building a large dome, or actually an arch, that kind of swoops over and keeps any radiation from going beyond.
Wow, just
beyond
a sort of
roof.
Sort of shield on top of everything.
Yeah, shield. Yeah. It's a huge, impressive, you know, feat of engineering. Yeah. And they have to build it slightly away from the reactor on track, so when it's done, they can then slide it into place. But you know, the deadline keeps getting, you know, moved further into the future, and even then, you know, plans are that cleanup will continue, and they will try to slowly dismantle the core of the reactor and move it into some kind of, you know, safer nuclear waste disposal. But that could be decades.
Well, George Johnson, a whole entirely different side of Ukraine. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
George Johnson is a journalist and a science writer. His article, The Nuclear Tourist, is in National Geographic magazine. You can read an excerpt of his article and see some of the striking photos of his visit to Chernobyl. That's on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Her music has been described as heartbreaking, intimacy incarnate, and staggering in its lack of self-consciousness. Up next, Word of Mouth sits down for a conversation with the singer-songwriter Mira, who's on her way to New Hampshire this week. A conversation with Mira when Word of Mouth continues after a short break.
Word of Mouth. Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. You're listening to the song Sweepstakes Prize by Mira. It's from her 1999 debut, You Think It's Like This, But It's Really Like This, which introduced the world to her playful, often suggestive lyrics and lo-fi production style.
You remind me of a firework, boy. You touch the ceiling, you touch the floor. You sparkle and burn, but you take your time. And I bet I could carry you across state lines.
On her new album, Changing Light, Mira sheds that signature sound for something a little slicker and that youthful tone for a voice that's a little older, a little wiser, but still invites you in. That's No Direction Home from Mira's most recent album, Changing Light. She's going to be performing on Friday, September 26th, at the Music Hall in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. As it happened, I spoke to Mira the day after her 40th birthday and asked whether the transition from lo-fi rocker to sophisticated songstress was intentional, or is that just what happens as you get older?
It's interesting, you know, listening to a clip of Sweepstakes Prize, and I recorded that so long ago. I think it was 1998, mm-hmm. And you know, I do think I have grown older. I've experienced a lot of things, and also it was a purposeful choice with the production of the new record to just try some new things. So you know, I'm not going to keep making like lo-fi bedroom pop records forever, even though, you know, sometimes when I listen to the old ones, I'm like, I really like that. That's the real me. There are amazing things that can happen with limited resources. And then it's also really fun to be like, I'm going to go all out on this one and have, you know, and sing with an orchestra or something.
Well, let's get an example of what going all out sounds like. This is another track from Mira's new album, Changing Light. This one is called Oxen Hope.
No matter how much I wail like a boxer I train, seems like the future's always gonna have its way. Knocking me down, should I fold or spread my fortune hand on this hard rock bed? And I don't question, no, I don't doubt, now that I've tried living with and without, that there's a hard, hard muscle to grow in, harder still to let it go.
And Hope from Mira's most recent album, Changing Light. What amazing images in that song. These two, you know, mighty, muscular animals soldiering on, yoked together, and then not. I'm wondering about, as well as the production process for you, the songwriting process, how is it different for this album than it has been in the past?
Well, this album, you know, I've written songs that would be considered, you know, breakup songs. I've written a lot of songs about my personal relationships, but this album is the most cohesive one that I've made in terms of, you know, addressing a really specific process. It was one breakup in particular that inspired many of these songs. I did try to capture the experience from as many different angles as I could as I was processing through them. It's definitely an album about a journey that I experienced. I wrote the album as a way to share that with people. And yeah.
Well, let's hear a little bit from one of your earlier albums. This is the song Special Death. Now, in 2011, this was featured on television's American Horror Story. So first, let's just hear a little bit.
The thankless holy place is left alone. Why bother?
it's strange for you, Mira, to hear a song that was at the time nearly a decade old rise to the surface in such a big, big way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is pretty interesting. It happened with another song from an early record that was on So You Think You Can Dance, like 10 years after I recorded it. It's a little bit strange, but it's great to reach new people. And then it's good for me to be able to connect again to my older material and feel like it is still relevant. So it's been good.
And I just want to go to another song here from the new album. This is Gold Rush from Changing Light.
After the gold rush shook off the gold dust, after we'd taken more than God had meant for us, we dammed up plenty but still felt empty. The land was rich but we left it poor. And I've spent to find some, but I will share. I know you're thirsty and unprepared. When I wet my lips with love, you feel me there. But then I'll run from you, 'cause I'm scared. And I train myself to run this way, I train myself to fly. And I dragged you all this way without an understanding why. And I'm holding on.
And that's the song Gold Rush by my guest Mira, and it's from the album Changing Light. Sweeping strings. There's something cinematic about it, especially this touch of Ennio Morricone, I think. You know, are you a fan of old westerns?
Well, you know, I did have a moment of obsession with them and with that music a bunch of years ago when I was recording my second album called Advisory Committee. I had a song on there called Cold, Cold Water. And I recorded that with my friend Phil Elvrum, who's, he was the band The Microphones, and now he's the band Mount Erie. That song was greatly inspired by specifically listening to Ennio Morricone and other sort of spaghetti Western soundtracks. And for Gold Rush, there wasn't a specific reference point for us when we were arranging that song, but that's what people have responded to about that song, is this sort of cinematic quality. I mean, boy, do I wish I had an amazing budget for a music video for that song, because it definitely deserves to have an over-the-top film display going behind it. But
I have to say, we can form pretty good pictures as listeners, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, thank you for bringing that up. There's sort of a lot of pressure to have tons of video content these days, and I understand that's the way a lot of people like to connect to music, but one of the reasons why I love what I do is because it exists as vibrations in the air. I make it and then send it out. You can close your eyes and listen and just be completely inside of something. Leave your devices behind. So yeah, maybe all the best that I don't have the budget for a music video.
Well, Mira, what a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really look forward to the show.
Well, and happy recent birthday. It just gets better after 40 as far as I'm concerned.
That's what I hear, so I'm looking forward to it.
Mira is going to be performing at the Music Hall in Portsmouth on Friday, September the 26th. And there's a link to much more information on the show at wordofmouthradio.org.
All days and all nights I spend dreaming. I'm fine with it 'cause I find it pleasing to get slow when I get below the time. When I'm listening to the radio of my mind. Old tapes and old.
Thanks so much for joining us today. If you like what you heard, there's plenty more at wordofmouthradio.org. Earlier, we spoke to George Johnson from National Geographic about his trip to the site of the Chernobyl disaster and the offbeat trend of nuclear tourism. If you'd like to see photos from his visit, we have some compiled on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. They're pretty spectacular, and we highly recommend checking them out. We come by the zaniest travel ideas via word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please come back for more of the stories for the perpetually curious. Tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.